Welcome to Goodniks, a podcast about doing good in the world. Together, we dig into the experiences of people who do good in very different ways to understand what inspires them, what frustrates them, and what keeps them going. I'm Annalisa Enrile, a social worker, professor, and human rights activist. Whether you're doing good yourself or just thinking about it, I'm glad you're here. In our last episode, we heard about what inspired our Goodniks, the moments that stuck with them, propelled them to do the work they do, and shifted their view of the world. Sometimes these inspirational moments were welcome. Other times they were absolutely not. But either way, they shaped our Goodniks journeys. In this episode, we explore the moments our Goodniks came up against the limits of what's possible in their line of work. We also asked them what turned out to be a difficult question. How do you make peace with the things that don't work out? I should warn you, a couple of these stories are tragic, one of which briefly touches on suicide.
I think that in general, mental health is probably the biggest category of my limits. We're trained as police officers pretty well on how to deal with mental health. And in the past 9 years of being a cop, I think that's the most training that I've had to endure, is learning how to respond to a mental health call or someone that's in mental distress, whether it's someone that is diagnosed with a disorder or something, or is just going through a mental breakdown, or having to deal with people with autism or some sort of other diagnosis.
Sam is a police officer in a small town in New York State. His story is like something we've all experienced. No matter how hard we try, our help isn't enough.
We used to have a group home in my jurisdiction that has since closed, where we were up there 4 or 5 times a day. So I think one of the worst calls was that one of the students that I knew up there, because we dealt with him many times, before he had come from a really, really difficult upbringing. Both of his parents were addicted to drugs and were in and out of jail. He himself at 16, I believe he was at the time, was also in and out of jail through family court and through juvenile facilities. He had been kind of moved around being with his parents, one of his parents, if they were out of jail, but then back into foster care and then in and out of group homes, and eventually made it up here, which was going to be his permanent residence until he turned 18, which is what the court said. Having been in the surroundings that he, in his childhood and up to this point, and then being put into a group home facility was not the solution. And I'm happy that the school's, like I said, since closed, but for him, that was not a solution. And it made him worse, because when he first came to the school, I got to know him just from going on calls there. He was a relatively friendly kid, although we knew he had a difficult background. But I don't know if he was picked on or what, but he finally had a pretty difficult mental breakdown and went into crisis and was throwing rocks at windows and breaking windows and fighting with other kids. But it was this kid was the kind of kid that I wanted to do, and I wanted to help him as much as I could. So every time I went up to the Graham School, I would check on him. Every time that I was up there and I had the minute just to speak with him and get to know him and create that rapport with him, so that when he was going into crisis or he needs someone, he could call and he could reach out to me and we could work it out. But this day it just got a lot worse, and we ended up having to arrest him, which I think was a solution in that day, because it got him out of a situation that was really toxic and he really needed to get out of there. So he was out and he didn't go to jail or anything. He went back to the school later in the night, but it gave him a few hours break to kind of de-escalate, and I was able to talk with him. The reason that I'm giving this story as a limit is because about 2 months later, I'd been working with him, but about 2 months later, he went AWOL from the school and committed suicide. I think that it affected me, because I had been trying to work with him and trying to get him into the right direction. But we put him into kind contact with mental health crisis teams and different people in the school that worked with him, and his social workers and caseworkers. But to know that was my limit and that I couldn't go any further to help him, and then find out that he had committed suicide, was pretty shocking and upsetting. I don't think that there is making peace with it. When I went through the academy, it has changed twofold since then. Now that they're not teaching the same way. But when I went through the academy, it was a lot of old school ways of thinking, in the sense that they would teach you there's a light switch. And what happens at work happens at work. And when you go home, you got to turn that light switch, flip it. And that your family life is your family life and your work life is your work life. And those are two separate lives that you have to be able to differentiate between and say, okay, well, I can't bring my work home to my family. Because if I had, the day that I had found out that kid had committed suicide, I was at work. Personally, I'm pretty open to talking to my friends about it. I don't speak to my mom about it at all. I don't speak to my sister, but cops have a tendency to hang out and be friends with other cops. So all my best friends are cops. But again, this is, it's interesting because they teach you about the light switch, or they taught, I should say. They taught you about the light switch and being able to shut it on and off. But they also tell you, don't only be friends with cops. You can't only be friends with cops, right? Because, and they say that in the academy. Why? Because cops are messed up in the head. Because we see all this stuff and we experience all this stuff. And what's a coping mechanism is when you're with other cops, you tell the stories of what happened. So they tell you, don't only be friends with cops, because if you're only friends with cops, that's all you hear. You hear these depressing stories and you hear these miserable things that happen to people and these miserable things of families, and it's depressing. So you have to have that out where you're not friends with other cops, and you can go out and have a drink or get dinner with someone that's not a cop and be able to decompress and talk about the Yankees without it having to be about cops somehow, or talk about the weather or going on vacation or whatever. So I don't think that there's a peace with it, because there's some things on this job that I've experienced that I don't think that I would ever be able to make peace with. It would be impossible.
Our other goodniks also struggle to make peace with what they can't fix, with people they can't save. Jesse is an expert in building movements, organizing thousands or sometimes millions of people to make change.
I don't think I've figured out what to do when I reach an impasse. I will share like a deeply personal reflection on that front. There is something about being a movement entrepreneur, a movement maker, where you develop almost this like unnatural sense of like, you can problem solve your way out of almost anything. You just keep rearranging the puzzle pieces, you rearrange it, and you like find a new path forward. And that starts to feel like a superpower, right? A year ago, in October of 2020, I lost my best friend in the whole world, my younger brother. I lost my younger brother to cancer after a 5.5-year brutal battle with a cancer called Ewing sarcoma. And it probably will not surprise you that I fought alongside my brother that cancer like it was a movement. From every specialist to finding every possible clinical trial to manifesting every possible amazing special surprise and trip during his life. And it didn't matter what I did. It didn't matter what financial resources were available to us. It didn't matter that every expert on the face of the planet was available to us. Ewing sarcoma is a horrific kind of cancer. And after 5.5 heroic, epic years, I held my brother's hand and I watched him pass away. And we're 22 months apart, and I shared nearly every element of my life with him. And in some ways, that was the first time in my life where like my ability to rearrange the pieces of the puzzle, like I did not strategize my way through my brother's illness. It is like shook me at the core, and it is changing my perspective on things at large, because there is no separation between me, Jesse, the human being, the sister, the daughter, the movement builder. Like, these things all come together, and there are things we can't change in this world. And sometimes there is defeat we have to accept, and we have to figure out how to live with that. I would say that I experienced paralyzing grief for almost the first year. And someone recently said, Jesse, there's something different in you. And I think this will apply to my movement building life as well. And I said, the thing that's different in me is that I've stopped trying to like organize the grief out of my life. Like, I am going to be heartbroken and devastated that my brother is gone for the rest of my life. The question is, what is going to live alongside that heartbreak and devastation, right? Like, what is going to live with it? What is going to be like entwined around it, but it's always going to be there. And that mind shift is like helping me wake up in the morning and remember that there are decades left of life for me and to get through my own medical issues. And I think it's actually really relevant to movement building as well, which is, you know, there are going to be a lot of losses. I've already experienced a lot of losses when it comes to movement building, but it's not even just like putting those out of mind. It's like you live with the loss and you remember that pain and you see what you're going to build around it and on top of it and out of the kind of, so to speak, ashes of what has fallen. But nothing was going to make losing my brother palatable to me in any way. But in some ways, what made it worse is I think I convinced myself over the course of his illness that I could organize a way for him to be better. And, you know, I think my family would say that about me as well. And ultimately accepting that we aren't always all powerful in that way is incredibly difficult.
David founded a nonprofit that organizes against genocides around the world.
It all boils down to unresolved trauma. We have generations and generations of unresolved and transmitted ancestral trauma as it relates to our countries and the West's original sin with respect to slavery, genocide of indigenous peoples. And that reverberates. It has echoes in our society, and we haven't done the full work to do even step one. So in my organization's platform, number one was acknowledge, document, and preserve the truth. What's being contested right now in every forum? What is true? Critical race theory, or, you know, what did or did not happen? What can or can't we teach to our young people about what has happened in our past? And if we're not operating with the same set of facts, if we're not able to meet across the aisle or across lines of difference, then we can't solve climate change. We can't do anything. And so to me, the biggest issue and the reason why I was so dedicated to this was I just saw that this was sort of like a bellwether for kind of everything. If we are unable to collaborate and solve problems and show up for and on behalf of each other through allyship, and I think the biggest barrier to that is a lack of understanding across lines of difference because of past wrongs and wrongs that are happening and reoccurring because we don't understand each other, that we're not going to go very far as a society. And I also really want everyone to embrace the fact that the arc of progress doesn't automatically bend towards justice, right? Like, we have to do the bending. It gets said over and over. It could also go completely the other way for society. And that can be a highly technologically advanced, terrible global community. You know, we can have advancement in some ways, but we also can go backwards to the Stone Age in some senses. And perhaps we should look back at the Stone Age and to eras of indigenous thriving for other forms of collaborative wisdoms that some might call more feminine or other things that we sort of lambast. But I think addressing our intergenerational cultural wounds on a macro level, but also as individuals, because that's where this has to begin, in ourselves and in our backyards. We can't make peace in the world if we can't make peace within ourselves.
Deborah is a social worker, a psychotherapist, and the founder of community programs that serve women and youth in Los Angeles.
As long as I know in my heart that I've done my due diligence, really, that I've done everything in my power to advocate for change, that I talked to this one and that one and made appointments here and there and whatever, that's needed. As long as I feel that I've done everything I can, and now it's really out of my hands, then I think the satisfaction comes when I know that, let's say, I have given now, kind of passed the ball to the next person that I feel that can actually create that impact and change. And I see that person or that entity follows through, or even when they don't. Like I said, if I feel like I've done everything I can, then I'm okay with that. But also, looking from the outside in, if I see that maybe certain things are not being done or what have you, then maybe there's another way that I can actually continue to impact. Where else can I support that will create impact into whatever it is that I want it to be addressed? You know, by being in committees, by being in different groups of same concern, whatever. But I would continue to do that. But for the most part, if I see that, you know, I've done everything I can and whatever, and there's still maybe something that is too big for a change, then maybe I also count that maybe there are some steps that I already took in order for me to maybe possibly address, maybe not now, but maybe down the line, and being okay with that.
Max is a co-founder of a center in New Orleans that's redefining recycling.
So I'd read something about all these folks, these specifically elderly folks who couldn't get to, you know, the drugstore, couldn't get to the pharmacy because they didn't want to go out. And I was like, okay, brilliant idea. Let's get these drones that can deliver their medication directly to their door, totally contactless. Contactless, yada yada. Call up this guy Max and I'm like, hey, we gotta do this. I've etched out some sketches, like crunched the numbers. It totally makes sense. And he's like, dude, we can't save everyone. And I think that's something that stuck with me, because it's like, although your intentions are so in the right place, where you want to do good and you want to do as much good as you possibly can, there is a point where it's too much, and the good that you're currently doing is going to fall by the wayside, you know, or you're just going to burn out if you are only focusing on doing these things and not on yourself, especially on, you know, or your loved ones, especially during these challenging times.
Michelle is the director of planning for a community institution in Miami.
When I was in college, I came out while I was in college to myself and to my family, and I was working at a synagogue as a youth advisor. And so I was a little nervous about, you know, what would that be like to share, you know, my orientation at work. And so I didn't. And then I was involved in the Jewish community and in the Lesbian and Gay Alliance, as it was described then. And then I was running for student government. And as I was seeking endorsements from different groups, the Lesbian and Gay Alliance endorsed me. And then it came out in the student newspaper that they endorsed me because I was a member and supported the platform and supported, you know, the work. And I went, oh my gosh, you know, I was just outed in the school newspaper. Now what? And so I talked to the person who had been quoted. And then the next day there was a retraction that said, setting the record straight, which was hilarious. And so I realized that this was not a hole I was digging myself out of, you know, and I wasn't going to deny it. I spoke to my boss and it was not an issue, but it was, you know, it was a fear that I certainly had. But I think that experience also freed me to recognize that sometimes the fears that we have about what could happen are worse than the reality. I was lucky to be in a situation where, you know, I didn't have really negative repercussions, and I was elected to the student government, so that was good. But it was a very difficult time to be coming out. It was certainly not as accepted as it is today. And even today, it's not easy for many.
In this episode, we heard about moments our Goodniks realize they cannot fix everything or save everyone. I know how heartbreaking and frustrating that is. It's a reminder that when your purpose is to do good and create change, you are going up against some pretty formidable obstacles. But what resonated with me most is the grace and resilience our Goodniks demonstrated in the face of these limits. In many ways, dealing with limits is an act of letting go of what we cannot change or control. There's no easy way to do this, but there are steps. Acknowledge you did everything you could. Accept your feelings about the limits. Reframe your perspective. Learn something from the situation. What are those lessons? And what do we take with us to continue doing good? In our next episode, we reverse course and ask our Goodniks what went really right as they were doing good in the world. Were there signs along the way that they were on the right path? And where did they find the validation that they needed to keep going? Thank you for being part of GoodNix. GoodNix was created and executive produced by Jeff Leitner, produced by Amanda Roscoe Mayo, with original music by Adam Ullendorf. I'm your host, Annalisa in Relay. GoodNix is supported by the Jim Joseph Foundation and inspired by every one of you who is doing good in the world. To learn more about GoodNix, visit goodnix.org. That's GoodNix.org. Or follow us on Twitter at TheGoodNix and on Instagram at the_GoodNix.